It gives me great joy to have the chance to introduce Father George Rutler. I think most of you know him from EWTN, his series, Christ in the City, from his book on the Quarry of Ours. He's got a new book out on World War II. One of my joys when I have had the chance to go to Manhattan is to stay at the Church of Our Savior, where he is the pastor. And one night we were talking about Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen, and he said he stole everything from Monsignor Knox. So after the talk on Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen, now you will hear about the one from whom he stole it all. Without any further ado, Father George Rutler.
Actually, Fulton Sheen told a friend of mine that everything he got was either from Knox or Chesterton. So he was very honest about it. You made me feel very guilty in the last talk, talking about preparing. So after dinner tonight, I prepared this talk. We have the Traore in New York and many churches. When St. Agnes Church burned for some 7 years, we had it in the ballroom of the Waldorf Hotel. A woman I had never seen before was very pious. After one Good Friday, came up to me. I preached this 7 last words, no notes. And she said to me, "I think you have a special anointing of the Holy Spirit to be able to speak for 3 whole hours without a single thought." it's a gift, perhaps, from below rather than above. We have a large, a widespread misconception that preaching in the Catholic Church is something we are only recently discovering. Of course, we know. I mean, we've had it all along. All the great doctors of the Church were preachers. And we have a misconception about the Council of Trent, as if the Council of Trent was a reaction against Protestantism in the sense that it emphasized the sacraments over and against the preaching of the word. I pulled out of the storehouse something very old, my doctoral dissertation from Rome. I'm appalled to see that I wrote this 31 years ago. I can remember going to the publisher to pick this copy up. It was when the Red Brigade was holding forth in Rome, and they had anti-terrorist police out. And a friend of mine had a car, so he was very popular. And he drove me, and the printing house was on a small lane, and there was a barricade up, and all these men with machine guns. And my friend said to me, "I didn't know that your epistemology of the Council of Trent was so controversial." Actually, this was it's a comparative epistemology of the Ars Predicandi of the Council of Trent in its 3 sessions, plus a few other ideas. Don't buy the book. Well, wait until it comes out as a major motion. The Council of Trent emphasized the art of preaching, the sacred art of preaching, emphasized the fact that it is the primum officium of the priesthood. The priest is the prophet, priest, and king, by delegation of his bishop, because bishop is the chief teacher, he is the chief priest of the diocese, and he is the shepherd, or in a more radical form, the king of the people, the name of Christ the King. One of the consultants at Trent was Peter Canisius, great preacher. So there you have a good example of how preaching was not only tolerated, but was really flourishing then. One historian says of Canisius, and this is a model of the Tridentine preacher, and what the preacher should be in all times, he understood the essence of Protestantism far more impressive than harnessed defense appeared to him the positive teaching and strengthening of the Catholics. And therefore, this element dominates in all his writings. Luther's coarse popular wit, passion, agitator's rhetoric, and wholly lacking in him. Instead, there appears in his mostly Latin works the closest familiarity with Holy Scripture, extensive acquaintance with the Fathers, and with the positive and scholastic theology, an earnest humanistic culture, great reading of the works of the Protestant theologians, a dignified polemical readiness to strike, piety, a decision, and the mildness of a generally apostolic man. One characteristic of the Counter-Reformation churches, the great pulpits, the emphasis was on preaching. It's expressed in the architecture. But for various reasons, preaching as a primary focus in Protestantism led to identifying the great oratorical traditions with the various Protestant sects. And so, for instance, we have in the 18th century a John Wesley, who certainly had unprecedented effect on people. The whole world is my parish. Ronald Knox said that John Wesley combined the intellect of a Jesuit with the morals of a Jansenist. And knowing what Knox privately thought about Jesuits and publicly thought about Jansenists, that was a necessary problem. But these days we have to speak very well of Jesuits. And then in the 19th century, celebrities go away very quickly. The most famous preacher in the 19th century was Charles Spurgeon. In England, he was a Baptist, as a prodigy, famous as a preacher at the age of 17. He built a large tabernacle in London at the age of 20. Tens of thousands of people would flock to hear him, because this is before radio and television. He wrote a great deal, over 100 books, and he sold over 1 million copies, which was a phenomenon then. His critics mostly were not Catholics. Catholics didn't care, really. He was written off the map. But the Anglicans deeply resented him, as vulgar and unlettered and so on. But he was extremely erudite. And obviously very effective. He died when he was only 56. He went into a deep depression once after someone who was hostile to him started a riot during one of his rallies and shouted fire, and 6 people were crushed to death and 20 others were seriously wounded. That only happens in my parish infrequently. Those were the obstacles he was up against. Died at 56. You could do a little essay on figures who died at the age of 56. Of course, historically we know that people are going to die at some age or another. Thomas More was 56. Of course, he died an unnatural death. We have Abraham Lincoln. At Abraham Lincoln's face, he looks 100. And there are people who take on the burdens of their nation, and then others who inflict burdens on their nation. As a preacher, I find it very important never to discuss from the pulpit politics or religion.
Thank you. So I will not mention politics today, but Abraham Lincoln was 100 at the age of 56. Another well-known politician died at 56 without a line on his face, Adolf Hitler. So there's a sermon in that. In fact, there's a sermon in everything. Ronald Knox was born out of a Protestant tradition. He was the son and grandson of Anglican bishops. His father was a very well-respected classical scholar. In the Victorian age, the Anglican clergy were renowned for their general erudition, and the Rome used to refer to them as the supermundi, the wonder of the world. But it's interesting that he was born in 1888, because Newman comes up too from that old pulpit tradition. But in both Knox and in Newman, we see the refinement of that the method with solid content. His father was a suffragan bishop, auxiliary bishop, we could say, of Coventry, and then became Bishop of Manchester. Now, in the great golden age of the British Empire, we have to remember that the Church of England was an extremely important influence in the world. Throughout the empire, it established churches, schools, and a bishop had a tremendous amount of social clout. His father was a staunch evangelical, very much opposed to the Oxford movement, the High Church movement. And Newman was considered more than a suspect, he was considered a traitor. But as with Newman, Knox took the best of what he had informed him and refined it. Knox was a child prodigy, no question about it. He was a true genius. So when we're talking about the preaching tradition in the church, we'd have to say you have Newman in the 19th century and Knox in the 20th century as just total geniuses, and theologically and in terms of their influence and rhetoric. When he was 4 years old, he said, his auntie asked him how he spent his day. And he said, every day I think a lot, and then when I go to bed, I reflect upon the past. Not bad for a four-year-old. But when he was about 7 years old, he was writing a little family newspaper in Greek and translating it into Latin for his little sister. This is not exactly Leave It to Beaver. And his father doted on him and encouraged this. He had an older brother, Edmund, who was a journalist, well-accomplished writer, and they all were classical scholars. He was a Greek orator at Cambridge University, and during the Second World War, the government was very clever. They took people of all kinds of ability, mathematicians, physicists, and classical scholars who knew the roots of language. And they studied the enemy codes, and it was Edmund Knox who was one of those who broke the Enigma code of the Nazis. He had a brother, Dilwyn, who became editor of Punch magazine. This was a very happy family. You know, they didn't look upon their intellect as a burden, and they enjoyed things very much. This is one of the outstanding things about Knox, is his wit. Now, Newman was very witty, if you read his novels and that. but he was not really, you know, Henny Youngman. but Knox, everyone loved Knox. I have never known anybody who knew him who didn't like him. Everybody called him Ronnie. Anyway, and then he had a sister, Winifred, who was a writer. She married Lord Peck and wrote a lot on social reforms. And his youngest brother was Wilfred. Wilfred was a high church Anglican and helped start in Cambridge University the Oratory of the Good Shepherd, which was an Anglican version of the Oratory of Saint of Beirut, not Neary but Beirut. And I belonged to that for a while because I was brought up Anglican myself. People don't believe that; they think I'm a Copt. But and they were very close. But the other boys went to Harrow School. Ronald was sent to Eton, where he was first of form, head boy, and so on and so forth. His closest friend there was a young fellow named Harold Macmillan. Mm. They remained very close friends all their lives. His other brothers, as I said, have been in Cambridge, but he excelled them all so much he was sent to Oxford. And don't tell any Cambridge people that. And from the very start, he excelled in especially classics. He was a very high church radical. He loved upsetting people, and he used to satirize the Church of England. Although he was ordained in the Church of England eventually himself, this very much upset his father, the staunch evangelical, and eventually he belonged to a society, a high church society, called the Society of St. Peter and Paul, which was dedicated to the reunion of the Roman Church and the heretical English Church. And since he was a clergyman of the English Church himself, they thought it strange he was calling himself a heretic. But, you know, he said, let's face facts. He became a chaplain there, Trinity College, and after much introspection, he renounced his Anglican orders and was received into the Catholic Church. This had a tremendous shock value in England because he had already, in his 20s, established a large literary reputation in England. And above all else, it very much upset his father, who originally had threatened to disown him. He couldn't bring himself to do that. But it was a very difficult situation all around. But you have to remember, you're not dealing with a theological disagreement here. You're dealing with a kind of Freudian rebellion against the father, but also because of the establishment of the Church in England, it was considered in many quarters to be almost treasonous. He wrote a reflection on his conversion. Being a classical scholar, he used Virgil as a model, and he called it a spiritual Aeneid. Later on, he said it wasn't the best thing he ever wrote. In fact, he said it was a youthful indiscretion. But it certainly is worth reading to see what he was going through at that time. What was the Catholic Church in England to do with him? His protege, and it was kind of awkward, and he was assigned to teach in a Catholic school, St. Edmund's, which the cardinal at the time was trying to build up into some kind of competition with the other secular or Church of England boys' schools. You had Ampleforth and Stonyhurst, who were very well established Catholic schools at this time. St. Edmund's was a small, largely unknown school. When the boys at Stonyhurst were full of beans once, they challenged the boys at Eton to a football match or rugby match. And they received a rather snobbish reply. What is Stonyhurst? Now, you have Jesuits and Benedictines running these schools, so they commiserated, and they sent them back. Stonyhurst is what Eton used to be, a school for Catholic gentlemen. He never was a parish priest. He spent most of his life, a large part of his priestly life, as the Catholic chaplain in Oxford, trying to fulfill the ambition of Newman to have a Catholic college there. The Catholic chaplaincy was a rather novel thing. Cardinal Manning would not allow Catholic students to go there. But finally, this was altered. The Catholic chaplaincy was there to provide catechetical instruction to young Catholic gentlemen who were in the various colleges but were in danger of losing their souls. And it occupied what was called the Old Palace, which is the old bishop's house, which is right across from Christ Church College. It was very simply run, still is. The school inspectors did not approve the living accommodations for student living. They thought it was rather degraded. After all, it was about a 400, 500 year old building, and it hadn't been fixed up in a few hundred years. But Knox lived in it. He lived very, very simply, very modestly. He helped to get a housekeeper who did the cooking, and he had about a dozen students who did eventually get permission to board there. He'd pay very little attention to food or anything. But he always, one of his little eccentricities was that he always had bananas for dessert because they said it had all the vitamins you need, and because they were contained in the peel, you didn't have to use a dish. It was to this group of about 150 students every Sunday that he would preach, and his lectures after the mass published in various forms. He preached very briefly because he had to give these instructions afterwards. On major feasts, he did preach. And he did preach, of course, splendidly. The students would come, flock to hear them. It's rather reminiscent, in a way, of Newman. Well, Newman, before he was a Catholic, when he was university chaplain in St. Mary's University Church, so many students used to go hear him that the dons of the colleges rescheduled tea time to encourage the students to stay away. He was lecturing in classics at the same time and doing a lot of writing to help support the chaplaincy. He wrote a series of detective books to help raise money. He belonged to a detective club, detection club, with G.K. Chesterton, Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, and so on. It was quite a crowd. And he was able to reach out to people who were non-Catholics, because he was not in any way aggressive or intimidating. And his style was so compelling that people, had to, as I said, had to like him. He was a rather shy man. Later on, when he left the chaplaincy, he was assigned to translate the Bible. And he lived with friends, not far away from Oxford. He led a rather quiet life there. Then he moved to the house of other friends, Lord and Lady Asquith. He was the Lord Earl of Oxford and Asquith, and his he was a father, had been a prime minister of Asquith. You cannot say he led a very simple life and a very humble life, but it was a kind of well-paced life. It was very much that of a university don. He himself said that no one lives a more peaceful life and comfortable life than an unmarried don. And I said he was somewhat shy. I know this from friends who lived in Nell's with him, that he would never preach if it were just his immediate friends there. He felt rather self-conscious about that. I never knew him, but I knew a lot of people who did know him. In fact, I lived over there for 1 year with the Suffragan Bishop of Birmingham, who then became Bishop of Portsmouth. He used to serve his mass. And I was there when they celebrated the 100th anniversary of his birth. And everyone remarked that when he preached, and I got this too from a priest at the London Oratory, he would write everything out meticulously. And he would have the manuscript in the pulpit, but he knew it so well by that time he never looked at it, but he always had it there. So what he preached was in ready to go to the printer condition. He used a lot of material over and over again. There was not much, there was no television, of course, and there was some radio broadcasting. In fact, he made a big mark nationally, writing for the Times of London, and doing radio broadcasts. He was, as a humorist and a wit, on one occasion, he did a satire on the BBC about a riot, on a coal strike or something like that. And this caused a great deal of panic, and the Cardinal was not amused by it whatsoever. But that, it's believed, is what gave Orson Welles the idea for the radio broadcast of the War of the Worlds. He gave many retreats to religious orders. The Catholic Church was really coming to its own at the time. He preached at festivals all around England, was the guest. Because a large number of the Catholic clergy in England at the time were Irish, who had come over. In fact, shortly after he was received into the church, he went to preach in one of these churches, and the Irish pastor started filling a water glass with Jameson's. And Knox says, "Please, Father, remember, I'm only a convert." He did engage in a lot of controversy, but in a very, very polite way. And, of course, was very, very persuasive. His conferences began to draw many non-Catholics. And again, he didn't count converts as notches on his gun or anything like that. Cardinal Bourne had made clear his view that the Catholic student should be given a series of apologetics. And these appear then later on in his book, In Soft Garments. He did other meditations on the Eucharist. He's totally oriented to the Eucharist. Many, many of his sermons are preached at either Corpus Christi Church in London or at St. Patrick's Soho. Where, by the way, Fulton Sheen had been a summer supply for a while. Sheen knew Knox. Sheen always said that Knox wanted him to teach up there, but I never found that anyplace else. Here's an extract from one of his conferences to students in 1939. "It is just over 40 years now that Leo XIII first allowed Catholics to go up to Oxford and Cambridge. If he had foreseen the course of things, he would have said to them, 'I send you forth as lambs in the midst of wolves.' Wolves in sheep's clothing, if you like, wolves in old Etonian ties and so on, but wolves for all that. I mean in the sense that their bewildered acquiescence in our modern materialism is an influence working for the labefaction of all sane principles. If he had seen you sitting here now, that great Pope would have wished you, I think, the gift of tenacity." His most renowned book was written originally in 1927, The Belief of Catholics. And in the preface he says, this book is an attempt to write constructive apologetic to assert a claim, and if the specialist feels inclined, as doubtless he will, to buttonhole me here and there with a demand for fuller explanations, I must offer him the discourtesy of hurrying on. There is no space for them. A book of apologetics must not be too long. It is not a work of standard theology. It exists to assert a claim, to state what I believe. And he says he's dealing with people who have a distaste for religion and a continuing hostility towards the Catholic Church in particulars. And he says, dogmas may fly out the window, but congregations do not come in at the door. And so he had to compel the people. And he did that, I think, not only by the sharpness of his intellect, but just by the congeniality of his personality. Unlike a lot of the great pulpit orators, he was very understated, and his real motto really was "cupio dissolvi." He wanted to disappear. He didn't. He would have been appalled if anybody talked about his public persona. He went out of his way to seem colorless, and by so doing, paradoxically, of course, he attracted so very many people. I don't know anyone in which you can, or any preacher in which you can find something original in everything he preached. You know, this is the Ignatius Press, the Pastoral and Occasional Sermons. And I defy you to find any sermon in there whatsoever that is not in some way an original insight. He wrote a series of published in a small tract called St. Paul's Gospel, in which he exegetes the message of St. Paul. Basically, his thesis there, with all, and it applies to the Gospels too, is that the Gospels are largely long prefaces to the Passion. To understand Christianity and preach Christianity as the Passion and Resurrection of Christ. And everything else, the obiter dicta, but it is preparation for that great event. He also stressed the fact that in preaching, you have to understand that it's different forms of preaching, and a mistake that preachers make is that they want to have a symphony orchestra with one instrument. But there are all kinds of instruments, and there are all kinds of music. Not everything is a symphony. Okay, you can have a great panegyric, you can have an occasional sermon of which he was master for special occasions, but then you have homilies at Mass as distinct from the devotional preaching. Some are a different length than others, they're in a different environment, and they really even sound different. So we have to understand the situation before we decide the form of preaching. His greatest task was the translation of the Bible, and he wrote a lot on the art of translation. I think the Knox translation now is rather dated. More recent translations have gone to the original sources, which he certainly could have done, but he was mostly concerned with Englishing, in putting into the vernacular the already received English texts. And there's a very funny address he gave when they had a luncheon to celebrate the completion of his translation. He attracted many people as a preacher by referring them to his secular books, his detective books. He has one, I think it's very hard to find now, Literary Anecdotes, which is one of the funniest books I've ever read, on different subjects, on teaching Greeks to people who don't like Greek. Another one, French with Tears. He has one in which he actually takes a diary of a 19th century Anglican canon of a cathedral who had taken upon himself to go to Rome and persuade Leo XIII to become Church of England. And, he makes a lot of hay out of that. It's great. It was his gift for friendship, I think, too, that made him such an attractive preacher. Now, what does that sound like? It sounds like John Henry Newman. If you go to John Henry Newman's in the rooms in the Birmingham Oratory, there's a little chapel there. All around the altar are pictures of daguerreotypes that his friends we pray for all the time. A tremendous influence on Newman, on the entire world, was the First World War. Almost all of his closest friends were killed in the British Army. You know, when you go to the old schools in Europe, you know, you look at the memorial tablets, 80-90% of the students killed. And that explains Europe today. I mean, you cannot wipe out a whole generation of young men and expect that civilization to perdure. And this was a very, very heavy burden on him. From then on, in the university, every time he turned around, he was seeing ghosts. But he felt an obligation to the sons and the grandsons of so many who had died. And towards the end of his life, all this kept coming back to him. He took a very strong stance against nuclear warfare. I suppose by any kind of political categorization, he would have been considered a conservative Tory. But he was very much opposed to the bombing of Hiroshima, Nagasaki. And he wrote a book, some say it was the most important book he wrote, God and the Atom. So all the while, you know, he was only 69 when he died. He was very much aware of what was going on at the time. He never lost the gift for the vernacular. When you read his sermons, it's a very different style. I think it's more like a kind of a fireside chat, and that's not everybody's style. And most of the preachers would be considering in the seminar weren't that way. But he would say, well, that's fine. You have different situations. I mean, I could not imagine Ronald Knox speaking to 100,000 people. That was not his milieu. But I do think we could say, with some confidence, that if there are two preachers of the church that we know will be read as classics 500 years from now, it'll be Newman and Ronald Knox. He was diagnosed with liver cancer. He asked the doctor, is it painful? And the doctor said, no, this is a gentle kind of death. And he said, I expected that. I did not think I would be worthy of anything else. Everyone knew he was dying, but he never said so, although he became very yellowish. In 1957, he said his last mass and was able to be helped into the Sheldonian Theatre in Oxford, which was where ceremonies, graduation, commencement ceremonies, academic ceremonies take place. And he gave there the Romaine's lecture, a famous endowed lecture on some classical subject. And he spoke on the art of translating Greek. And he uses an example, the translation of a Greek epigram, translation by an Oxford Don, William Johnson Quarry. You have to imagine this fellow now in his academical robes, clerical collar. Everybody knew that this was the last time he would speak publicly. He didn't say it. But he just ended by reading this epigram as Quarry had translated it. They told me Heraclitus, they told me you were dead, they brought me bitter news to read and bitter tears to shed. I weep when I remember how often you and I would tire the sun with weeping and send him down the sky. Now that thou art lying, my dear old carrion guest, handful of gray ashes long, long ago at rest, still thy pleasant voices, nightingales awake, for death he taketh all away, but them he cannot take. That was his farewell, and everyone knew it. but one also had a sense that he was reading that to all his friends, the soldiers, fellow students of the university, who had died in the Great War. And by remarking, which I think is a very important insight into Knox, that some of his most attractive preaching was done by to children. Great minds, always like children, because they don't think they know everything. And so people who do know everything enjoy people who don't know everything. During the Second World War, some girls at the girls' school in Kensington were evacuated because of the Blitz, and he became their chaplain. And he wrote the famous series, The Mass in Slow Motion, the Creed in Slow Motion. And he also did that on occasion at various Catholic boys' schools. And in 1950, he preached. This is this great, great genius. And he preached this to these boys. Let us remember that the curtains of heaven are transparent curtains, not in the sense that you or I can look in, if only we could. What a world of good it would do to us. No, but the saints can look out. They can see you and me, still plowing our way through the mud and darkness of this earthly existence, feeling our way with difficulty and falling every now and again into the ditch. And they can help us, not only because the light of their example shines down on us and makes it easier sometimes to see what we ought to do. They can help us with their prayers, strong prayers, wise prayers, when ours are so feeble and so blind. When you look out on a November evening and see the sky so studded with stars, think of those innumerable saints in heaven all ready to help you. After he gave that closing lecture in Oxford, he went by train to London to spend his last night at 10 Downing Street with his old friend Harold Macmillan. And Macmillan had him in the Prime Minister's car, took him to Victoria Station, and the Prime Minister said, "Ronnie, looking back, if I had been the one to Pope, perhaps now you would be Prime Minister, and I might even be a Monsignor." And then he said, "Ronnie, get on the train, have a comfortable journey." And Knox said, "Harold, this will be a long one."
Mm-hmm. So we have plenty of time for questions and input.
Well, how well received was his version of the Bible in comparison to the Revised Standard Version?
The Revised Standard Version had many critics simply because it was revised. And there are a lot of people who didn't think that the Authorized Version, as the official title of the King James, should have been changed. Others realized that they should. There was one woman who objected and said that if King James English was good enough for St. Paul, it should be good enough for English. But his translation was in a certain way more accurate, but it was more radical. So I don't think it really very much caught on. It was more used for study purposes. I don't think he really meant it to last very long, as certainly liturgically. It was not used liturgically. And he did say that if the translation is successful, it should not last very long. And this is, I think this is something very important to remember with preaching. We can look at, we can read the book of St. Peter Canisius, or we can read Newman, or you can see films of Fulton Sheen, and some of it, I mean, seems melodramatic or might even risible, seem risible. But there's a certain sense in which if it weren't dated, it wasn't timely. But I do think when we're dealing with people like Newman, and when we are dealing with someone like Knox, we're dealing with something that is both timely and classical.
Can you say anything about his preparation for preaching, the way he would approach preparing for a particular sermon?
He didn't explain that very much. In fact, as I said, he was a shy person, and he sort of kept that sort of thing a secret. There were people like that. When I was talking about 19th century preachers, certainly in New England, one of the most famous of his day was the Episcopalian Phillips Brooks. In fact, everybody had a picture of Phillips Brooks in his house. He was a big celebrity of the day. Now we only remember him because he was a poet. He wrote O Little Town of Bethlehem and the like. But in his study, a man was browsing around and just picked up one of his manuscripts that he had been working on, and he grabbed it right away and took it away. So one time he is recorded as being sharp. So I think he was a bit that way too. But he did have a luxury of time. He had many hours at his disposal. He pretty much worked out his own calendar. Friends would come in and visit, and he always gave the appearance of being quite nonchalant about things. He was also very keen on martinis, I might add. So that might have been... There's a variety of spirits at St. Paul's.
George, you told the story of his approach to death. I've read that, and he went off from Victoria Station to where? Where did he then die?
He's going back to Mel's.
With the aspirates.
The aspirates.
Died there the next day or within a week?
No, I think within about three months.
Oh, as long as that.
No. That was in 1957.
Yeah, but that parting, when Macmillan said, hope you have a good journey, he said it would be a long one. That was beautiful.
The bishop I mentioned that I lived with, this guy, my landlord, his father was Christopher Hollis, who was a very famous writer, a very, very close friend of G.K. Chesterton, and closest friend of Evelyn Waugh. Now, Evelyn Waugh, we know, did not have the gift of seeing the best in people. Christopher Hollis was one of the few people that Evelyn Waugh ever spoke well of, with the exception of Ronald Knox. Evelyn Waugh adored Ronald Knox and volunteered to write his biography, which is certainly worth reading. And when you read *Brideshead Revisited*, for instance, you're seeing getting a little glimpse into the world in many ways of Ronald Knox. When I mentioned before the distinctions he thought so important in different forms of preaching, he was he mastered the art of the panegyric, which is something that's been largely lost today. We have this problem now, this infection of eulogies at masses, which is an abuse. Don't get me going on that. but the old practice was that the requiem, and if there was preaching to any degree, it would be on the theology of death. And then on your month's mind, or some other occasion, you would have a panegyric, which would be a tribute, a thanks to God for this individual. And he was the most famous panegyricist of his day. And since he was such a very close friend to Chesterton and influenced Chesterton's conversion, he preached the panegyric for him. Mm-hmm. And it's really worth reading in this, it's the end, towards the end of this collective works. Let me just give you, read you a paragraph. This is in Westminster Cathedral. The man whom we laid to rest the other day in the cemetery at Beaconsfield was one of the very greatest men of his time. If posterity neglects him, it will pronounce judgment not upon him, but upon itself. He will almost certainly be remembered as a great and solitary figure in literature and artist in words and ideas, with an astonishing fecundity of imaginative vision. He will almost certainly be remembered as a prophet in an age of false prophets. He warned us in spacious times that human liberties were threatened, and today human liberties are in debate. He warned us in times of prosperity against the perils of industrialism, and industrialism is laboring for breath. He warned us when imperialism was a fashion, that nationalism was a force not easily destroyed. Today nationalism is the shadow over men's hearts. I will say this, that if every other line he wrote should disappear from circulation, Catholic posterity would still owe him an imperishable debt of gratitude so long as a copy of The Everlasting Man enriched its libraries. This I will say, that whenever I ask an inquirer whether he has read any Catholic books, his answer regularly begins, "I read some Chesterton, of course. We live only in our life, and after death our name shall not be such." Few men of our time could refuse that epitaph to Gilbert Chesterton. And meanwhile, blessed are they that saw him and were honored by his friendship. They found in him a living example of charity, of chivalry, of unbelievable humility, which will remain with them perhaps as a more effective document of Catholic verity than any word he ever wrote. But the familiar voice, with its high chuckle of amusement, will reach us no longer. He, whose belief in immortality was so publicly influential, can give us no whisper of reassurance now that he knows. Only we know what we would say if he heard the suggestion that nothing remains of him beyond what was interred at Beaconsfield, for he himself wrote, "The sages have 100 maps to give. They trace their crawling cosmos like a tree. They rattle reason out through many a sieve that stores the sand and lets the gold go free. And all these things are less than dust to me, because my name is Lazarus and I live."
George, his grandfather was Bishop where? You say his father was Bishop of Manchester. Where was his grandfather Bishop?
He was a missionary bishop.
Oh.
In India.
Probably also an evangelical, I guess. Mm.
Because the evangelicals were the ones who were more mission.
Yeah, of course.
Oriented. It's much the same way in this country. You know, they used to say that when the West, Wild West in the United States was opened, the Baptists went out on horseback, yeah, and the Methodists went out in stagecoaches, and yeah, the Episcopalians waited for the invention of the Pullman car. CJ.
Robert U. Benson in Knox, was there any relationship there?
If there was, they didn't talk. He didn't talk about it, mm-hmm, very much. They were very, very different. Now, there again, Benson. How do you explain this? Benson was a prodigy of a family of prodigies. Mm-hmm. All his brothers, you know, his one brother was a famous professor of literature in Cambridge. He was the official biographer of Queen Victoria. Another one, poet. He wrote the words to Land of Hope and Glory. He has, they were all very eccentric. His sister was an Egyptologist, and at one point she thought she was being haunted by the Egyptian god of the underworld, and she ended up in an asylum. But Robert Hugh Benson had a streak of that. And I really he used to preach here in New York. He would come over to New York. He loved locomotives and would ride trains and things with the conductor. But he was, if we had a film of him today, we'd probably just laugh at it. He was very dramatic and would perspire and almost faint, disappear, then pull himself up in the pulpit. And then he had to take long baths afterwards. But the people loved it, you know. For the time. But I think if you said to Knox, do you know Monsignor Benson? Cambridge, the other thing.
George, I think Benson's father was Archbishop of Canterbury, wasn't he?
He was, yes.
Yeah. Well, I think there's an anecdote we want to tell the brothers. All right. Maybe 5 or 10 years after the Archbishop's death, Robert Hugh Benson went to Canterbury Cathedral with a friend to see the tomb and the recumbent effigy of his father. And his friend said, admiringly, he said, you know, I think for a man like that, there is no purgatory. And Benson said, well, I think I'd give him about 15 minutes.
There's always that kind of, you know, satire, satirical love-hate thing between the high church and the Catholics, right up until recent times. Well, it's hard to satirize something which is sort of self-satirical these days. Someone said of a recent Archbishop of Canterbury, of course he's for same-sex marriage. He wants to marry himself. Cardinal Hume. Cardinal Hume was the first Archbishop of Westminster to attend the enthronization of an Archbishop of Canterbury since the Reformation. Because he used to be Archbishop of Canterbury, of course, and some of the unecumenical Catholics refer to him as the Archlayman of Canterbury. So Hume had his own procession before the ceremony began with his choria, and the Times of London, which doesn't approve of any kind of religion, you know, but just likes to make fun of them all, said that Hume entered the cathedral at a steady pace, regally looking at the fabric of the cathedral with the eye of a landlord, come after a long absence to inspect how the tenants have been tending the property. It was Easter Day, of all places. I got on the email a request for a contribution from the Thomas Cranmer Society. They must have found my name in a file someplace. And it was there it was called Episcopalians for the Episcopalians for Authentic Tradition. So I sent them a note back. Which I thought Knox would have approved of. I said, I am a vegetarian for authentic barbecue. But we almost love one another because it's Easter.
George, any influences of Knox on your own preaching that you're aware of?
Well, Newman was the big man, and I have to say it was kind of, I have to say I really think it was something supernatural, because when I was a student first over there in the 60s, my big hero was John Keble, whom Newman adored, and I thought that Newman, you know, had betrayed the ranks and that, and I thought it was a great honor to stand in Keble's pulpit. But then, and I remember I was magnetized in that pulpit, very hard to understand. And then some years later, I was back there, I was doing the postgraduate degree, and after I had come out of my viva, the viva voce, the viva voce is called the oral exams, I came out and I had passed. They were very, you know, they were pretty strict. It was a kind of, Anglo-Saxon Inquisition. So I had my academicals on. I went up into that pulpit, but I realized at that moment it was Newman. And when you talk, when you read it, of course, you'll hear about Newman. But if anything, the Knox influenced me. It was what he had been influenced by Newman, because the Newman was very much like Knox, and there was no histrionics at all. Ars escalare artum. Art consists in concealing your art, making everything look effortless. And think of all the work that Newman put into his preaching. But when he got up there, it seemed like it was a kind of conversation. You had to listen very carefully to him. So I think that was a primary influence. And also in the Ars Predicandi, in both, you have this in both Newman and Knox, something that Mozart, a very talented musician, said, two lines of Mozart I love. He said to the Emperor Frederick once, because he had been criticized for being loud in the palace, and he apologized to the Emperor, and he said, "I know I am vulgar, but my music is not vulgar." And the other line was that the music is the silence between the notes. So you'll find a lot in the pulpit style with all these men, they leave a pause, so you could just sort of let the people digest this for a moment. Also gives you a little time to think. But I think that was that tradition, and I don't know how that would. I think it still works. It still works today. The old Code of Canon Law, 1917, did not really perpetuate the tradition of Trent, as I was saying before, and as preaching is the primum officio. They did acknowledge that there was missionary preaching, devotional preaching, novena preaching, and I think that's why, in the last couple of generations, the decline of devotions, decline of benediction, decline of vespers, decline of missionary preaching, the only preaching people have is at Mass. Many people think Mass is the only form of worship. I mean, I have to deal with brides all the time who don't think they're legitimately married if there's not a nuptial Mass. The old code said that the sermon, as they called it then, was a legitimate interruption in the liturgy, which is certainly not what Trent said.
What was Knox's influence on Fulton Sheen?
Fulton Sheen admired him very much. He went and visited him, and as I said, he thought that he was under the impression that Knox wanted him to go up and assist in the chaplaincy. What he said, teach there, which I've never heard anybody say that, and I can't imagine that, but. I don't think they would have personally gotten on very well at all. I mean, personalities, they were chalk and cheese. Each had his own gifts, so they were very, very different gifts. Sheen, but it was through the influence of Knox, I think, that Sheen met Chesterton, or at least corresponded with him. And he was able to prevail upon Chesterton to write the preface to his dissertation at Louvain. And when Knox preached that panegyric for Chesterton, in Westminster Cathedral was young Fulton Sheen. I mentioned that the Code 1917, that was the year that Cardinal Mercier, which Father Macron mentioned, 1917, he wrote a pastoral letter to the priests in Belgium, saying that we have failed the people, for we tell the people to love one another, but we do not tell them why. And if we do not tell them why, if we do not know what Christ did, they do not know that, then their love will fail. So, I mean, there in 1917, you have someone addressing the problem of moralism in preaching, not as the fruit of catechesis, but as a substitute for catechesis.
You mentioned similarity between Knox and Newman, but when you mentioned especially Knox's gift of friendship, I thought a little bit of St. Philip.
Oh, yes.
So I wondered what in particular, how much of a connection did Knox have to the Birmingham and London orators?
He was very close to the oratory in London. In fact, when he was being prepared to be received into the church, he lived for, I think, almost 2 years in the London Oratory. And it was a priest of the London Oratory I was talking to, not very long ago, who very much remembered the Knox preaching there. And he was the one who told me how he always had the manuscript there. It's all written out, but he didn't have to look at it. He might have glanced down once in a while. So it's not all that long ago. Knox was born 2 years before the death of Newman. And I once spoke to a man, great grandson of William Wilberforce, who as a small child heard Newman preach. So I heard a man who heard the voice of Newman. This is very important. And Newman loved Neary. Lives, almost 200 years before. But there's no question that that tradition went right down to Knox. And that's another thing. See, this is one difficulty in preaching today is that people don't know history. I have nothing against novelists, but life is much more interesting than novels. Especially when you live on Park and 38th Street. I talk about that. When the Iraq War started, the police gave me a code number. If I saw anyone in the neighborhood behaving strangely, I said, if I did that, their phone would be ringing. But here you have St. Ignatius, St. Irenaeus, recalling how St. Polycarp had heard St. John. That's two generations. Now they've decided that the whale, what kind of whale is that? The broad jaw whale or something like that. In the Arctic can live to 200 years. So in other words, you get 10 of them and you're back to the resurrection. I am three handshakes from Abraham Lincoln, because I knew a woman whose father knew Lincoln, and I am five documented handshakes from George Washington. And it was considered very unusual because Washington very rarely shook hands. He put his hands behind his back and would bow, in the old style, because handshakes only came in with the Reign of Terror as a sign of friendship. I love you, and so this is a point to get across to people. This is just in the purview of the history of the world, like nothing. I am two handshakes from Rocky Marciano. I am one handshake from Gene Tunney, and I went into the boxing. I'm on the boxing team, and I went into the box Modell's boxing shop by Grand Central. And the proprietor was not as impressed as I had hoped he might be when I told him that he was four handshakes from Felix Mendelssohn. I guess it was in the wrong shop. That's an example of a preacher not really knowing his people. But your people are fast, and if you're short on, we're never short on material, but if you want something very interesting, you say, just give them the light of the saints. When you're buying a car, you say, let me get in and drive around the block. And what better proof of the truth of religion is than the saints? Just tell the people that. And I've never, ever heard anybody bored with the life of a saint. That, you know, that great line of Newman, the little girl asked him, are you a saint? And he didn't say yes, he didn't say no. He just said, well, saint, cardinals are of the earth, saints are of heaven.